is the less obvious side. A little more than 30 years ago, I was a student in Oxford for a year. I was doing, nominally, I was doing a master's in mathematical logic. But the most interesting thing for me in hanging around in the Maths Institute in Oxford for a year was being able to go to various events pitched at audiences much like this, mixes of philosophers and physicists who were interested in, well, what we'd now call philosophy or philosophy of physics or foundations of physics, questions about space and time and quantum mechanics and so on. And it was in the context of one of those meetings that I first heard a talk by Roger Penrose, whom up until that time I'd only known of by reputation as the leader of what was what all the master students regarded as by far the most exciting and cool research group within the Maths Institute, the Twister Group. And then some years after that, when I started to try to work myself on issues to do with such things as the arrow of time in cosmology, the sort of one source of insight into those issues which stood out for me above all was Roger's writings, the kind of thing which is in the wonderful chapter on the arrow of time in cosmology in The Emperor's New Mind and in various other writings from around that period. And so, I mean, I think it's literally true to say that if I hadn't had the advantage of that kind of insight, then my own work would never have been able to take the direction that it did, and so I certainly wouldn't have been standing here in the midst of a meeting such as this one. But on the more sort of institutional side, I mean, I only learned from Lucien the other day of Roger's contribution in the conception of the whole PIAF project, and so I'd like to thank him on behalf of all the people involved in the PIAF collaboration for that, and also for coming along to show his support at this, the first PIAF conference. So thank you very much, Roger, and welcome. And we look forward to hearing your talk on clocks at the Big Bang. Quantum gravity is not what you think.
Thank you very much. Well, you may see that my ideas haven't changed all that much since then. I hope a little. This hasn't changed. The question is what you mean by quantum gravity. And normally, I think people mean the application of standard quantum procedures or quantum field theory procedures to general relativity or perhaps some other gravitational theory if you can't make that one work. But on the other hand, it might mean, and to me it does mean, some more even-handed marriage with give on both sides. And this would involve not just a modification of space-time structure, but a modification of quantum mechanics. So that's, you might call a somewhat unconventional view, although I'm sure there are people here who share that opinion. Now, to me, the main issue is what's sometimes referred to as the measurement problem, although Tony Leggett calls it the measurement paradox, and I'd agree with that. Basically, it's the paradox between unitary evolution on the one hand and what happens, at least in the world that we perceive, when you employ the measurement procedure, which is certainly non-unitary. Of course, you can go to many worlds and then you have to have a theory which explains what you see in terms of conscious perception or something like that, which always seemed to me to be a much harder problem than even the purely physical one, which is to try and explain the physical world that we actually perceive and what are the laws that govern that. And measurement is part of that, and measurement doesn't seem to be a unitary process when you have one alternative as a measurement and not just some density matrix or something, which doesn't seem to me to give you one alternative. It gives you, well, it doesn't even give you a probability mixture until you interpret it in that way. But let's not go into that. I seem to me there is a problem here which needs to be resolved in some way. It doesn't, of course, mean that the resolution of this problem is concerned with what I was calling quantum gravity. However, I think there are various reasons to think that gravity is something, is the relevant thing to marry quantum mechanics with. And there are various reasons for this. One of them is the space-time singularity problem, which, after all, quantum gravity is it was always one of the motivations for doing quantum gravity, that one could resolve the singularities in one way or another. But then there is this time asymmetry issue, which I want to talk about today. And another issue related to it is the Hawking black hole evaporation paradox, information loss paradox, as it's referred to sometimes. So I want to talk about that too. And first of all, though, I'll say something about the clash of basic principles, which seems to me to be one good reason for thinking that general relativity or gravitation theory is something where the rules of quantum mechanics might be subject to some kind of modification. And if the measurement paradox is going to find a home in some area which isn't completely new physics, but partly physics that we already know, then gravity is certainly the best place to look. And that's because of these principles. The equivalence principle and the general covariance principle seem to have some problems in relating to the superposition principle. I just want to make a few remarks about the equivalence principle. This is something which I've thought about for some years, and I've never quite finished thinking about it. So I'm going to give you an incomplete thought, which is the same as the thought I've been having for some time. Well, first of all, the equivalence principle, which you all know. If you fall freely, you don't seem to feel gravity. And according to Einstein, the freely falling frame is, in some sense, the more natural frame. And that's what Einstein calls the inertial frame. And so the question is, how do we think of quantum mechanics from the point of view of regarding free fall as somehow more natural than the alternative point of view, which is thinking of gravity as a force? Well, you see, here we have the two ways that you might talk about a gravitational field. Suppose you're doing some quantum experiment on the table. Then there are two ways you might think about that. You might introduce a force term. Let's see, I have to see what my color coding is here. You either have a constant gravitational field, and so you'd introduce your gravitational acceleration field into the Hamiltonian and do your quantum mechanics that way. Or else you could consider a freely falling field in which you've got rid of the, I'm considering a uniform field, so not worrying about curvature at this level, a freely falling field, and then transform back, considering your experiment to be accelerating upwards all the time. So I've used the purple one for the freely falling one and the green frame with the small letters for the one frame sitting on the table. And then you can, question is, do you get the same quantum mechanics? Well, what you can do is transform from your wave function, this is just a Schrodinger description, from your wave function in the sitting on the table frame to the wave function in the freely falling frame by introducing a phase factor here. I won't get into the details here. And there are experiments from old experiments to show that quantum experiments seem to be, it doesn't matter which way you look at it. But I do want to point out something which is not so frequently pointed out, which is that this phase factor, which relates the two wave functions, involves a time dependence, which is cubic in the time. So this means your definition of positive frequency and so on is different in the two frames. In other words, you have a different vacua in the two cases, strictly speaking. Now, this is quite related to the Unruh effect, where one's considering an observer falling into a black hole or an observer who's not falling in, just remaining hovering above it, say. And the question is, do you feel the temperature or what? And so on. So that's that issue. And you would consider that you have different vacua depending upon which frame you use, whether you're falling into the hole or hovering above it, or a long way off and remaining stationary. In fact, you have a different, one of these vacua is a thermal vacuum. But if you take the limit, the Galilean limit, so you let the speed of light go to infinity, then you find the temperature goes to zero. However, you still have this residual phase factor. And this phase factor involves the time in a nonlinear way. And so you therefore do have different vacua still, even though neither of them is a thermal vacuum. So this is an issue which seems to me to be one that you have to take seriously. And so I'm imagining a situation like this, where you have, you're just trying to do some quantum mechanics here in the, a background which consists of a superposition of two masses. Now, you see, if you adopt the Einsteinian point of view as opposed to this one up here, the small letters, if you don't adopt the big letter point of view, then the natural frame, well, there are two natural frames. There's the one which is freely falling into that one and one which is freely falling into that one. And they would give you different vacua, and the measure of the difference, that is to say the coefficient of the t cubed term, is where you substitute this g here, the difference between these two gravitational fields here. And so, well, that seems to me to be reasonably straightforward. The question is what you do with that. And, well, here I just have a cartoon of what's happening with the space-times. You see, here we have the gravitational acceleration field. I think I should just turn that over. The gravitational acceleration field of a single lump of material, and then you imagine displacing them with respect to each other, and then you have inconsistent acceleration fields, and so you might have to worry about what I was just talking about. And the contention is that you do have to worry about it, and the question is, in what way do you worry about it? So for the moment, this is just a provisional statement, is that you look at this coefficient of the cubic term in the time, and you regard that as a sort of difficulty that you have with forming this superposition, because you're looking at two different vacua and trying to superpose them. And what I'm basically doing is integrating that over space. If you integrate that over space as a measure of some sort of error in forming this superposition, this is strictly speaking, it's illegal, but the idea is that maybe you can keep that illegal superposition going for a while, and you'll only notice it after time when this error here, you use the time energy uncertainty relationship. And the time I'm using, I'm happy to say, is the internal one. So I'm hoping that Bill won't object to this. So here we have a measure of the error. And so I'm saying that's it's an uncertainty in an energy, basically. There may be a coefficient outside here which could affect, in practice, how big this term is. This argument doesn't give you a clear answer to that as yet, but maybe one could make it more complete. And the idea is that this quantity, which is this measure of error, can be reinterpreted as the gravitational self-energy of the difference between the two mass distributions. So I'm saying that's an inherent error in the energy of the superposition, and by the energy-time relationship, you then get a lifetime. And the proposal is that in a lifetime related to that by the time-energy uncertainty relationship, you can only expect that superposition to be able to last for that sort of time. So that's the idea. You can work out what this is for, say, two uniform spherical lumps. And we're just talking about Newtonian theory, really, here, or if you like, Newton-Cartan theory, where you're looking at Newtonian theory, but nevertheless thinking of the Einsteinian point of view with regard to reference frames. So nevertheless, that's Newtonian calculation, where the speed of light is taken to be infinite. And then here you take the superposition for two spherical uniform lumps. The only thing I really point out here, there's an explicit formula which you can work out, but the thing I point out is that about two-thirds of the effect is where you move the two instances of this sphere, spherical lump, from coincidence to contact, and that's about two-thirds of the effect. It's only about half as much again, moving it from contact to infinity. So the major effect is in the displacement of the mass, and doesn't matter too much how far away you displace them after that. Here I have another cartoon of this displacement, which you have to consider seriously, because matter, after all, isn't uniform. It contains atoms, it contains particles, it contains quarks, and so on. So you have to worry about what happens. You see, what I've just been doing is looking at the gravitational self-energy of the difference between those two mass distributions, where this is considered uniform. But then you think this is really made up of particles, which you, in modern physics, actually treat as point particles. So you might say, well, it's really a distribution, there's a whole lot of delta functions, and then the slightest movement will produce an infinite energy, and so you're in trouble. There's no quantum mechanics in this scheme. So that can't be it. So the point of view that I adopt here is what I refer to as a sort of minimalist proposal. There's no dynamics specified or anything. It's just to see in this particular situation what one might expect from this point of view. So I'm concerned with a quantum superposition of two states, each of which would on its own be considered as stationary. So in this situation here, I'm considering that the two on their own would each be stationary. The trouble with these delta functions then, you see, is they wouldn't be stationary. They would instantly spread out, and so that doesn't satisfy the condition of this minimalist proposal. However, if you have some material, then there would be forces and things you have to take into consideration, and there would be some mass distribution. And so it would be more like this picture at the bottom that you consider, not with delta functions, but with some mass distribution, and you might displace it by a bit, and then you could work out this gravitational self-energy would be some finite quantity, and work out what the time it would take on this proposal before it decays into one or the other. So that would be the idea, and that's this idea here. I should mention that Dioshi really had a proposal, essentially this idea, some years before I did. I wasn't aware of what he'd done, but he certainly had it first. He also had some dynamical proposal and so on, so it wasn't exactly what I'm calling a minimalist proposal, and so one might attack the particular dynamics he was suggesting. On the other hand, the idea he had the same figure for this decay time for a superposition. This EG here is the gravitational self-energy of the difference. People often think, oh, well, gravitational forces are so small, how can you expect any effect to come in and so on? But I should point out here that you have, in this time scale, a quotient between two things, each of which is small. And the decay time is, after all, in Planck units, if you take h bar to be 1. So it's the reciprocal of this energy, which will be very small, and therefore you have a very long time, but it's a very long time in Planck units, which is 10 to the minus 43 seconds. And it may work out, for some reasonable sized object, it's actually quite a reasonable time. So the kind of experiment that people have been looking at, working towards, I should say, Dick Baumeister in particular, but a number of other people apparently are doing experiments of this general kind. And Dick Baumeister's experiment is one where you're looking at a superposition between two little mirrors. Each of the mirrors is 10 micron. It's a 10 micron, sorry, it's one mirror. It's one mirror which is put into a superposition of two locations. The mirror is a little cube about 10 microns in diameter, so it's just a bit too small to see with the naked eye. I guess a good lens, you could probably see it. The displacement, though, between the two instances of this little mirror would be something like the diameter of an atomic nucleus. So in the picture that I had here, you're thinking of these things as atomic nuclei, and there would be some spread because of the forces and so on when you solve your Schrodinger equation and try and find a stationary solution, and that gives you the mass distribution in terms of the expectation value of the mass. And that's the idea. What they're aiming for probably falls short of this proposal by a few orders of magnitude, but the idea is that they would gain experience if they succeeded with that to go further. If they succeed with what they're doing at the moment, then it would, according to this proposal, quantum mechanics would come out again confirmed, and one would have to go a little bit beyond that. I was rather impressed seeing what they'd done in their experiment, because it's only about that big, you see. And this is about the time everybody's talking about the LHC. It's absolutely a huge thing. And there's this little experiment about that big. Anyway, now I want to switch gear and talk a bit about cosmology. I have to keep track of time. Including discussion. OK. Now here I have just the standard cosmological models. Time is going up the picture, as it usually does in this subject. And here we have when the older ones where we had no cosmological constant, Friedman models. And here we have what we now consider to be the case. Those of us who like relativity better than particle physics, where you might imagine some dark energy or something which varies with time, although I have trouble with that. But anyway, it seems to be positive. And then the different models, it doesn't seem to matter what the spatial curvature is very much. The different models have an exponential expansion in the future. You might say, where is inflation in these pictures? Well, it would be tucked into that point and you wouldn't even see it. It does have considerable significance, but I should say that the proposal that I'm making here, there isn't any inflation. But let's not worry too much about that. That's more the topic of what I'll say on tomorrow. Let me make one remark first about the negative curvature case. I'm not saying that's what I think the universe is like. It might or might not be. I just want to show you a very familiar sort of picture. This is an Escher picture of the conformal representation of hyperbolic geometry, often referred to as the Poincaré disk, I suppose because it was due to Beltrami, but I guess that's the sort of thing you've got to get used to in mathematics. And it's a very, this is a very extremely nice representation of it. You can see the straight lines as circular arcs meeting the boundary at right angles, and you can see that you have more than one parallel to a given line, and you have triangles whose angles add up to less than pi. this being a conformal representation, so the angles are accurately represented. But the main point I want to make about this is that you see the entire hyperbolic plane right out to infinity is represented by a finite region in Euclidean space. So the representation is conformal, but you can see the whole hyperbolic plane, and its infinity is a perfectly smooth boundary. So if you were one of these fish, you were right down here, you would think the geometry was just the same as if you were a fish in the middle. You have to stretch it out. Whereas if you were somebody like you or me, standing in the middle here and taking a step, you could go right outside there. That would be, if you're only interested in the conformal geometry and not the metric geometry, well, then there's nothing to separate the outside from the inside, you could imagine, going beyond this. So keep that in mind. That has some relevance to things that I want to say. Now, the next point is that these pictures, of course, don't take into account the second law of thermodynamics, which is very relevant. And here's this sort of standard cartoon about the second law. You can imagine this to be a Newtonian picture. And this, of course, is completely consistent with Newtonian mechanics going in this direction or going in the opposite direction. You don't ever see it going this first, this second, this third. And one way of expressing that is to say that the entropy is increasing. And this is what the second law of thermodynamics tells you. So it increases with time. One can sort of begin to understand it in terms of the Boltzmann entropy definition, where you need a phase space. So this, you have to bear in mind, has a zillion dimensions, or six zillion dimensions for if there are a zillion particles here, each position coordinate and each momentum coordinate contributing. And the idea is that you have this coarse graining. So that means that you have regions within this phase space of situations which resemble each other with regard to macroscopic parameters. So with regard to the details, the microscopic details, they might well differ. The individual particles are in slightly different places. But with regard to things like temperature, pressure, general motion of the fluids, gas and so on, chemical compositions and all that sort of stuff, you lump them all together. All the different microstates are lumped together into one region. And the region that you're concerned with would be the one whose volume goes into the Boltzmann formula. So we just have the logarithm of that volume times a small number here, constant, giving you the entropy. And then you must bear in mind that these volumes, despite my picture here, actually differ by an absolutely stupendous factor from each other. So you tend to find that this one, the ones near it might not differ very much in the sense of the entropy not being very different from the original one. But the volumes are likely to be stupendously different, partly because the logarithm here, you see, change the volume by a huge amount, and the entropy doesn't change much. And also, this is a small number. So your entropy might go up just slightly, but the volume is likely to go up absolutely stupendously. So this means that once you found yourself into a bigger one, you're hardly likely to find the smaller one back again. And so it keeps on doing that, and you get on into bigger and bigger volumes. And this is a sort of understanding of why the entropy should increase in the future. The trouble, of course, is that it doesn't tell you what the past is doing, because you could say, what's the most likely way for this glass of wine to have found its way onto the table there? And the same argument would then apply. You look for the greatest number of ways of getting there, and you find that it's something like this. It starts a great mess on the floor of broken glass, which jumps up into the air. All the wine finds its way into the glass as it assembles and perches itself on the edge of the table. Of course, that's the wrong answer. That's the answer which would tell you that the entropy goes up in the past as it goes up in the future, whereas it didn't. For some peculiar reason, it went down in the past. What actually happened here, of course, was that somebody who'd been drinking too much at the party had put this glass rather sloppily on the edge of the table, and it just dropped off. But of course, that was starting from a lower entropy, or consistent with the second law, and so on and so forth. So it doesn't explain the puzzle of the second law. It just explains the easy part, if you like, which is why it goes up in the future. But there has to be something special which dragged it down in the past. And to understand that, we really have to, assuming the second law continued right back to the Big Bang, you must ask for the answer to be somewhere in the Big Bang. Now, there is a kind of puzzle here, or almost a paradox, at least at first sight, because you might say, why do we know that there's a Big Bang anyway? And one of the good reasons is the microwave background. And this microwave background has the remarkable property that it's almost exactly a Planck spectrum curve. Here we have the microwave background. This is an actual Planck curve. It's the continuous line. And the error bars are given by these lines up here. Bear in mind that they are exaggerated by a factor of 500. So even the worst point right down here, to the eye, it would look as though the error bars were hugging the curve. So you have an extraordinarily precise Planck curve in the microwave background. And what's that tell us? Well, that tells us we're looking at thermal equilibrium. And you might say that doesn't make any sense, because the universe at the beginning ought to have been not the thermal equilibrium, which represents the maximum entropy state, not a minimum of some sort. So where is the answer to that paradox? Well, the answer is that the initial state, what does this tell you? This tells you that the radiation you're looking at has come from matter and radiation in thermal equilibrium. That doesn't tell you much about the gravitational field. You get some inkling as to what the gravitational field was like by simply looking all over the sky, and then you see a very closely equal temperature all over the sky and very equal uniform distribution. Not exactly, but very uniform. And that uniformity represents a low entropy when one considers gravitation. So here is the other cartoon that one often uses in this game. Here we have gas in a box. You imagine it's stuck into the corner by some compartments that you then remove, and the increase in entropy is accompanied by a more uniform distribution as time goes on. However, if these were gravitating bodies, lots of stars, say, in some huge box, then there would be some tendency for them to clump, and eventually you would expect some of them to fall into black holes, and this would represent a huge increase in the entropy according to the Bekenstein-Hawking formula. So that is telling us that the gravitational field has to be taken into consideration. And what we really seem to see is not this. That's what the microwave background is telling us. It's a bit like this. And what the uniformity of it, if you like, is this is the Planck spectrum aspect of it. The uniformity aspect is telling you something like this. So this is what you're really seeing, a combination of this and this. And therefore, there is a reservoir of low entropy in the gravitational form, and it's the clumping together of this material, which keeps the universe going, and we live off that and all sorts of things, and I don't want to go into details of that, but what we then have to modify our original picture here of the different universe models by saying, well, we have to consider black hole singularities, and that is the sort of thing we get, singularities in the future as well as the past. You see that when the cosmological constant's there, it doesn't make much difference. It is quite instructive, however, to think about this case, which we don't believe anymore, but where you have a closed universe starting with a Big Bang, and you see it's very grossly different from time symmetric, because black holes will form and they will tend to congeal into a great mess at the end. This is low entropy, this is high entropy, and so. Well, here's this point that I've often stressed here, that if quantum gravity is a straightforward quantum theory of some kind, then and there are so many more configurations look like this than look like this, why didn't the universe start off like that, because all those were possible types of singularity, and if your quantum gravity doesn't make a distinction between one and the other, there should be huge contributions to this initial state from geometries like this. And yet, that does not seem to be what we find. So the question is, how do you make your quantum gravity theory, whatever it is, fit in with this gross asymmetry in the singularity structure? And if you just introduce a bounce or something like that, that doesn't seem to me to be getting close to what one needs, because the bounce has got to aim itself to a Big Bang like this. And so you'd have something which started off like this the other way around and stuck onto this way around. And that doesn't explain why it was so special. A remark about black holes. This is just a space-time diagram of black holes. I'm using a conformal diagram sometimes here. It's just a convenient way of representing the geometry. If you have spherical symmetry, each point in this picture, you have to rotate it around into a two-sphere. The dotted line means a symmetry axis. The wiggly red line here means a singularity. And these lines here mean infinity. That's null infinity. These are the conventions which I've just been using. I've just been saying it, so let's not worry too much about that now. You might want to see how the various cosmological models look in this scheme here. When you have a zero cosmological constant, you have a null future infinity and a space-like singularity. That's the sort of picture you get. However, when there's a cosmological constant, the future infinity and the singularity have more of a symmetry between the two, although one is, of course, infinitely expanded and that's infinitely contracted. But nevertheless, that's the sort of picture that one gets here. A remark about conformal geometry, and I should say something about this is a conformal rescaling here, which is involved in trying to make infinity finite. And I should remind you that this is the, perhaps I should have put this up here, this is the Escher picture, of course. Only one is not talking about spatial geometry now. I'm talking about space-time geometry. And here, in an analogy with this, one has these future boundaries, which could be null or space-like. And so you have a boundary in the future, which comes about in very general circumstances, provided most of the matter that's left around is in the form of massless entities. And so that's the, you have a smooth future boundary. A lot of work I did in the distant past was on the case where you have null future boundaries, because I didn't know there was a cosmological constant. However, I did consider these other cases here, and it was one of the very immediate conclusions of this type of analysis that you do get a space-like boundary when you have a positive cosmological constant, a null one when it's a zero cosmological constant, and a time-like one, which is really rather bad news, I think, when you have a negative cosmological constant. So that's something to bear in mind here. Now, when you talk about conformal geometry, an important thing to think of is the Weyl conformal tensor. This has certain conformal invariance properties. But I want to think of it in a slightly different way, namely as an analogy with Maxwell theory. In Maxwell theory, you have two tensors, the charge current vector, which is a tensor, and the Maxwell field tensor. And this is the source for that. The analog of that in general relativity is you see the Ricci tensor. Well, its trace is reversed, but apart from that, it's the Ricci tensor, which is the analog of the charge current vector. And it's the Weyl curvature, which is the analog of the Maxwell field tensor. And this same thing has conformal invariance, just as the Maxwell field tensor does. In fact, Maxwell theory as a whole is conformally invariant. I don't know if I should spend time on that. I may need to go back to that one, but depending on how the time goes. Okay. Now, how do we specify the condition that the initial singularity is special in the sort of way that we seem to find with the universe? Well, this is just a hypothesis I'm making and made for many decades, say that the I just propose that initial singularities have a vanishing Weyl curvature. Remember, the Weyl curvature is describes the gravitational degrees of freedom. So if you say that the Weyl curvature vanishes, that's saying there aren't any degrees of freedom in the gravitational field running around. Somehow they build up later, that you kill them off. Whether you kill them off completely or almost completely is a separate matter. But anyway, you want to have some big constraint on the Weyl curvature. And that big constraint does give you pictures like this. If you just impose that constraint, but otherwise say the thing can be pretty general, then that does give you something resembling those models. Of course, you can't impose that constraint on the future, because if you do, you will not allow this sort of thing, and you don't allow black hole singularities, and this seems to cause more trouble than it's worth by a long measure. But, okay, so the Weyl curvature hypothesis, just as a hypothesis, seems to be something that we find. Now, here I have a picture representing a different point of view here. See, one of the troubles with the Weyl curvature hypothesis is it's rather difficult to say what you mean in a precise mathematical way. And the thing is, you want to say at a singularity, the Weyl curvature is zero or small or something. And the singularity, of course, is a place where your metric has gone crazy. And so it's a bit hard to say what you mean by, I mean, it depends on how you take the limit and all that. And do you mean Weyl curvature with its indices downstairs, some up, some down, upstairs, what have you? And you get different answers depending on which you do and how you impose that limit. Now, Paul Todd has been adopting a different formulation of this kind of condition, which I find very appealing. And that is that you can introduce a conformal factor which expands out, and I've showed you this in the symmetrical uniform cases in my conformal diagrams just a minute ago, but this is saying a bit more than that. It's saying that the irregularities that you're allowing in the universe are such that the stretching out of the Big Bang gives you something where the conformal geometry is smooth. So if you're just concerned with the light cone, so let me put this slightly different way, conformal geometry, you see, here's where clocks, of course, start to come in, and we need to talk about clocks here. See, the light cones basically correspond to 9 of the 10 components of the metric per point. It tells you where the light cone is. The actual scaling is 1 parameter, and that gives you the metric. So the metric over and above the conformal factor is just 1 number in addition to the 9 that you already have. So most of the geometry is in the conformal geometry. And if you don't have clocks, but you just have conformal structure, that's what tells you the causality and so on. So in many senses, it's more primitive notion than the clocks. So I'm saying, yes, it's more primitive, and you can get a lot out of simply the conformal geometry. And in fact, this is one thing you get out of it, is say that your space-time can be extended to a fictional, if you like, pre-Big Bang stage. And this is certainly how Paul Todd was looking at it. This is merely a mathematical trick. It's a mathematical trick which enables you to specify what you mean by the Weyl curvature hypothesis in a very neat geometrical way. And you get various things from this, the sort of second law as we know it, in the sense that it's the gravitational degrees of freedom which are constrained. You can also make some kind of estimate as to the specialness of the Big Bang, say within, you go back to our the particle horizon, extend it backwards in time, and say how many baryons were there at that time, and you get a figure for, if you push those all into a black hole, that's a big entropy you could get out of that, and that tells you how big your phase space volume is when you exponentiate that entropy, and you find a number like 10 to the 10 to the 123. Well, if you put the dark matter in as well, it gets to 10 to the 10 to the 124 and a half or something. So it's actually a bit more, but in fact, hugely more when you really think about it. But as far as the arguments are concerned, it just doesn't make much difference. Anyway, it's telling you how special that initial state really was. It's a huge constraint. We're not just fiddling around here. It's absolutely enormous, the constraint on the Big Bang. Now, okay. And the second law then seems to come about by imposing this condition on the initial state, that it should have be extendable in this way. Mathematical trick? Is it just mathematics? Well, there's a question, you see. Because near the Big Bang, If you go prior to the Higgs time or whatever it is when the temperature is higher than that and all that sort of thing, then you can sort of ignore masses of particles. And after all, it is mass that determines the metric, determines clock rates. Ultimately, I mean, to build a clock out of a single particle is not something one can do. But nevertheless, you can trace, I think, the fact that you don't have just conformal geometry and the fact that you need metric geometry to the presence of mass. For example, if it was just Maxwell theory and you didn't have any massive particles, then you'd have a conformally invariant theory. So, and a particle, of course, by the combining E equals H nu with E equals MC squared tells you a frequency assigned to each mass, purely times constant quantities. Okay, so that's the picture, is that in some sense, you see, as you go back and back and back near the Big Bang, the conformal geometry becomes the dominant geometry. And you might say, well, how does the universe really know that there's a boundary here, and perhaps it extends to prior to that? Okay, just keep that in mind. What is it, if it does, that goes on behind there? Well, now I talk about the future instead. And here we have to think about extremely remote future, where all sorts of things, lots of matter falls into black holes, and these black holes will stay around for an awful long time. Eventually, by the Hawking evaporation, they go off pop. Not a very huge explosion by astrophysical considerations, but nevertheless, from the point of view of the fundamentals, it's an issue about what happens to the information, in a sense, which went into forming that black hole. Well, here's something I'm going to agree with Bill on, that that Hawking was right originally, but when he changed his mind, he was wrong to change his mind, that the information is lost. And I'm going to try and explain why I think now there's a much stronger reason to believe that it is lost than before. And I hadn't really thought of this one, and I'll come to that. But let me first of all say what I'm expecting in the very remote future. Lots of stuff goes into black holes. It then radiates away almost entirely in massless photons and things. Eventually goes pop and some junk comes out at the end, but that's a tiny proportion to what went into it. So basically, there's nothing left. Almost everything that's left is just massless radiation. Now, I should point out that everything that happens here is consistent with the second law, very much so. All that consideration is very crucial to this disappearance of the black hole and so on. So the second law is operating all the time. Now, in my talk tomorrow, I'm going to take a rather more radical position than I'm taking here. For the moment, we can say, okay, there seems to be this future boundary, which comes about almost automatically. There seems to be this past boundary, which is a condition on the universe that we seem to find. And the more radical suggestion is that somehow these came together and the remote future was conformally extendable into the Big Bang of the next universe. And it's a crazy idea, which I'll say more about. And is there any evidence to support this or not? For the moment, I'm not going to worry about that. I'm just going to say that what we find is something that could fit. That is to say, the Big Bang has this character, as far as we can tell, and not too far from it anyway, of being something which, with a conformal factor, could be made regular. The remote future also is something which seems to be something, as a conformal manifold, is regular. Now, it's also the case that you can see the matching from one to the other, even if they actually match, just as a condition on the nature of what's going on here and what's going on here. The individual photons could go right through. I mean, the photons are doing more or less what they are here as what they are here. Whether they in detail do is another question. The gravitational degrees of freedom also do, but they don't go into gravitons on the other side. They go into distribution in the mass, which comes about through the infinite conformal factor scale change, which I would say it has to do producing new matter, which is what I would think is, in this viewpoint, the dark matter. All that thing is not really relevant. The point that I want to make is that there do seem to be roughly the same amount of degrees of freedom here as here. Yet, as the universe evolved, it started at a low entropy, went on, went on, and went on, and reached some huge value of entropy. How can it be that these things, whether or not they exactly match or not, seem to match very, very closely? And there isn't room, even if there are slight differences, there isn't room for that huge reduction in phase space volume, which seems to be needed in order to get from the very special big, well, from the very general future state here to the very special Big Bang. So how can that be? And I worried about this for quite a while. And it seemed to me there is only one answer, that at least that I can think of, apart from monkeying with all sorts of quantum mechanics in a much more serious way than I want to. And I should say that, yes, the point I should make here is that the phase space volume, the natural volume in phase space, you see, at first I thought, well, maybe the infinite rescaling between this and this is causing some great difference. But that doesn't work, because what is the measure of phase space volume? Well, it's a lots of dp dqs. And as q goes one way, the p goes the opposite way. So dp dq remains the same. It's invariant under these conformal scalings. And it's just in terms of Planck units, after all. So Planck's constant units. So there isn't any difference. That you can take the remote future here, squash it down by a huge conformal factor, and it looks awfully like the Big Bang. Take the Big Bang, stretch it out by this opposite conformal factor, and it looks awfully like the remote future. Awfully like, even if it's not exactly like, you have to explain why it isn't awfully like. And that's a big issue. So what's happened to all that phase space volume? Well, here is what I think the answer is. It has to do with the black hole information loss. Black holes, after all, that was what I used to estimate the entropy. There's a huge amount of entropy increase when black hole forms. There's also, as that black hole continues to swallow material information throughout its life, and that may be a long time because it's not just a question of its entropy, it's a question of how long it lives too. So it will keep on swallowing information. And the Hawking argument, you see here we have this conformal diagram, and the original Hawking argument was comparing the information here with the information in here together with that. So this together with this was sort of equivalent to this. Now, once you've lost what's in here by the evaporation, what's happened? Well, it's not, I think it's called an information loss. It's not really putting it strongly enough. It's phase space volume loss. Now, this is a crazy thought because phase space isn't supposed to change. You see, if you have ordinary dynamics and deterministic dynamics or quantum mechanics or whatever, without state reduction, one might have to worry about that. But the normal physics, you're working within one phase space, and you're looking at a point wandering around in that phase space, in ordinary classical physics anyway. So you're not supposed to change the phase space. But if you actually lose degrees of freedom, which is what's happening here, your phase space gets thinned down. That's basically it. It's this picture, although I need far more dimensions than you can see there. Here we have the degrees of freedom that you might be locally interested in doing some experiment on the table or an astrophysical experiment or what have you, even with black holes. Here we have the extra degrees of freedom which have got lost in the black hole. Now, as soon as that black hole goes pop, well, you might say the phase space volume has suddenly lost all those degrees of freedom. It's got a lot smaller. But it's got a lot smaller in a way that you just don't notice, because it's degrees of freedom you're not interested in. So the entropy, as far as ordinary physics is concerned, is going up all the time. It's just that the phase space volume gets thinned down. Every time a black hole goes pop, it gets thinned down. And I'm claiming that it's this continual thinning down, which mainly happens in the late stages of the universe, is what gives you your low entropy back again. But you see, entropy is an awkward notion here, because you say, how do you measure the phase space volume where you can use the Boltzmann formula for? Well, is that phase space volume just the degrees of freedom that you're concerned with here, or does it include those extra degrees of freedom that disappeared with the black hole? There's the additional point that if you say, when did that black hole disappear? When did those degrees of freedom disappear? Well, that's not a good question in relativity, because it depends on where you draw your space-like surface. Here we have a black hole. You try to draw your space-like surface to work out what the entropy is now when that black hole's around. Where do you draw it? Do you cut through here, right through the singularity, out the other side? Do you work your way right down to the beginning, loop around that, come back again? Still space-like. You can do that, but when it's gone pop, you've lost all that. Do you say the degrees of freedom get thinned down only at the pop, because this first surface, which stretches its way right down to here and back again, suddenly becomes a surface over here? Or do you say that as you gradually moved your surface up, there was a continual loss of those degrees of freedom? That's the kind of ambiguity that I rather like, in a sense, because it tells you that there is something that you can't put your finger on in this. The phase space gets thinned down, and when the black hole has formed and disappeared, it has got significantly thinned down. And it's that thinning down of the phase space volume which gives you consistency with the second law. And that's what I wanted to say. Thank you very much.
We have about 10 minutes for questions. There's one up the back there. I think the microphone is mainly for the recording, isn't it? So I'll give it to you for that.
Okay, Roger, your kind of continental drift argument about matching the singularity at the initial singularity to the conformal boundary in the future, is there an H-bar involved in that matching? Because, I mean, you know, there's a long history of thinking about quantum effects removing singularities.
Yes, yes.
But I don't see an H-bar
yes.
No,
I should have said, yes, I'm sorry, when I say quantum... the treatment of singularities is not what you think or something. What I'm trying to say is that this is, in some sense, a very conservative point of view, because it's saying that you really, at the Big Bang, classical discussion would pretty well do. Now, there is this conformal factor which changes from infinity to zero, whichever you're talking, which way around you look at it. But that is relatively minor. There is no kind of foam or anything going on. This is a smooth conformal manifold. So what I'm saying is that the key thing in asking whether quantum gravity makes your space-time go crazy is what the Weyl curvature is doing. Now, in black holes, yes, it goes crazy. Space-time goes crazy enough to swallow information and all sorts of things. And you probably need all the mad schemes that people have put forward in order to try and explain what a quantum space-time will be like. But the conservative point of view here is that I don't do that at the crossover between, because it's the curvature, it's the Weyl curvature and the scale of that which you have to consider. And that doesn't get big at all. So there's nothing in that transition, there's nothing in this particular point of view which gets you close to a real quantum gravity theory, which of course is very unconventional. One would always say, you know, we need quantum gravity to discuss the Big Bang. I'm saying that the trouble with that is you would have to introduce all these degrees of freedom, which we simply don't see in the Big Bang.
So let me try something, just one more thing, a little bit provocative. Uh-huh. Are you then sort of friendly with something like Julian Barbour and collaborators' proposal that really the dynamics of general relativity is conformally invariant? About the conformal geometry.
Well, it's not, I mean, I'd say the conformal geometry, the conformal part is the most important part. But there is a scale factor which plays a role, and you can't forget it. So it's not really conformally invariant. In effect, it's you can think of the scale factor as reducing. I think I can't go into this in too much detail without saying what I think the equation should be on the crossover, and that's perhaps going too far at the moment. But it's not conformally invariant. The free gravitational field is conformally invariant. That is, the waves satisfy a conformally invariant equation, which is the Bianchi identity equation. But you don't have conformal invariance overall, and where it couples with matter is not conformally invariant.
Julian Barbour, just to agree with you, Roger, and slightly correct what Lee was saying.
Okay.
There's two different models that my group have put forward. In one of them, the conformal geometry is the only thing that plays a role, but unfortunately there's no indication at all that it could describe the main facts of cosmology. And the other model which we've put forward is just a different way of showing how very strange general relativity is, in the, as you've exactly said, the conformal geometry seems to be very, very important, and then there's that little bit extra, which is the scale. But you, without that scale, you can't explain all of the facts of the Big Bang cosmology.
Okay, thank you. Yes.
Roger, I've got a question.
Yes.
Put myself in the queue here. As I understood it, in your original proposal, the basic asymmetry, which was the sort of solution that you had to the problem of where time's arrow comes from, in effect, was that you had the constraint that the Weyl curvature was zero at one end,
yes,
and not at the other end. But now if you can end up identifying the future, I mean, you've now got a story whereby, if I understood correctly, the Weyl curvature gets to be zero in the far future too.
Yes, that's true, yes.
So what's happened to the asymmetry on which the solution depended?
Well, let me make one point, that at the crossover, the Weyl curvature does go to zero. However, what you describe as the gravitational degrees of freedom goes into something which is scaled once by a conformal factor. And the thing which looks like a Maxwell field, but for spin 2 rather than spin 1, is actually finite at crossover. And that finite quantity, which gives you the gravitational wave degrees of freedom, gives you a non-zero normal derivative to the Weyl curvature. So the Weyl curvature is zero at crossover. It actually increases immediately on the other side by an amount which the gravitational radiation determines. And that is immediately translated into spatial conformal geometry. The Cotton-York tensor gets influenced by this. And also variations in density of the material which is created on the other side. So you don't see it, as far as I can see, directly in the form of gravitational radiation on the other side. The degrees of freedom are not there as gravitational degrees of freedom as we normally understand it. But it's a little bit of a subtle distinction.
You mentioned fluctuations at the beginning. Does that account for CMB fluctuations, or is that something totally different?
Oh, yes. Well, I if you want to hear more about CMB, cosmic microwave fluctuations. Did I say anything about it here? I may have said a little bit. I'll talk about that tomorrow, if you're going to that, in the talk then. There are observational, there's an analysis of the CMB data to see whether this scheme makes sense or not. It's in a flux, state of flux at the moment. I can't give you a yes, no answer to that.
Here is a stupid question. When the past and the future coincide, the temperature should be the same. But naively, the future's temperature is low, but the Big Bang temperature is high. How do you explain the same temperature if the past and future coincide?
Well, first of all, let me say the very vast difference in the temperature is just what you get from the conformal scaling. So if you take a very vastly expanded universe that we might expect in the remote future, and you simply squash it down by a conformal factor, you get a huge temperature. So that agrees. That's just a rescaling fact. Of course, it's hard to see, you know, how does this very cold universe correspond to an enormously hot one? But that is what you get from the rescaling. Of course, there are fluctuations which you might worry about, and this is related to the previous question. And so one has to address that one and see whether there is detailed agreement or disagreement between what we see and this proposed scheme. And I what comments I'm going to make on that, I'm leaving till tomorrow.
I think we've got time for one more quick question.
First, Roger, just a comment. Julian Barber again. I quite agree with you. There should be a more even marriage between the two theories than, say, quantum field theorists would like. But I would emphasize, in my view, that if one does buy the canonical approach and the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, that is already a very significant modification, at least in principle, of quantum mechanics, because unitarity, for example, would go out of the window straight away because there's no time variation if you take that seriously. So that's just a comment. And the other one was a query. I think when I was at your house a year ago, you agreed with me that the mystery is really that a solution of general relativity which is very smooth at one end and very irregular at the other is the mystery. That's the mystery.
Yes, yes.
And it's a bit, I think Hugh Price would object to calling one that sort of standing outside and saying this is the beginning and that's the end, and because by Boltzmann it's the smooth one that's the beginning and the muddled up one is the end. I mean, the yes. mystery is that any solution is smooth at one end and very irregular at the other.
Yes. Well, of course, in this model here, the irregularities, which are the black hole singularities, all disappear in the end, so they're not.
Oh yes,
end.
No. That's a further development from your original.
Right. Of course, if you had a closed universe in the old way, one had with zero cosmological constant, then this kind of discussion wouldn't work. So it does depend, and it also depends on the cosmological constant. That's crucial, because only then do you have space-like boundaries, so you can match that onto the past boundary. But in this talk, I wasn't perhaps insisting on the matching. So, although I will be tomorrow, I'm really just saying that the geometry seems to be of a kind that it's pretty close to being a conformal rescale, one to the other. And that's a remarkable fact. And on its own, it needs some explanation. And it seems to me you are forced into this picture, and unless somebody else has some other ideas, which does say that information or something, Fed space volume, gets lost, which does say unitarity is not preserved in the sense that black holes disappear and you don't have a reversible dynamics in principle. And so this suggests again that quantum mechanics will have to change fundamentally when it's united with general relativity.
Okay, I'm afraid we're out of time, so please join me in thanking Roger for a characteristically fascinating talk.